From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West.
I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the people who are almost completely left out of that famous photograph of the meeting of the Transcontinental Railroad. The historian Gordon Chang has a book that tells the story of the Chinese workers, nearly 20,000 of them who laid hundreds of miles of track in rugged terrain. And it wasn't easy, but Chang explores what he calls their lived experience. We'll be right back.
Have you added a new smart speaker to your home? They're amazing, right? In fact, you can make your Amazon Echo, Google Home, or Apple HomePod even smarter. Ask it to play KUER. Your digital assistant will serve up our live stream filled with the latest news and brain-expanding shows like Marketplace, Radiolab, and All Things Considered. To find out more about how to use your smart speaker, go to KUER.org and click on How to Listen. Or just tell your device to play KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When you get a minute this week, take a deep look at that famous photograph that marks the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad at Promontory Point in 1869. You'll be seeing it a lot this week as people celebrate the 150th anniversary of the moment. So look at it and think about what you see, but also what you don't. And what you don't see or won't see easily are any of the thousands of Chinese laborers who worked on the rail line for the Central Pacific Railroad, that line that began in California and went east. East through incredibly challenging terrain, by the way, granite mountains and vast deserts. The historian Gordon Chang says, we're not entirely sure why the Chinese were left out of that one photograph, but you can imagine. Because the way they were portrayed at the time, he says, rendered them all but invisible. Chang says they were portrayed as ubiquitous and indispensable, but they were never given a voice or portrayed as real human beings. So in a new book, Chang explains that they were, of course, human beings. They were hard workers for sure, but they were also literate and argumentative and funny. They were gamblers and opium smokers and, as he puts it, devout worshippers of the gods and spirits who watched over them in their perilous work. Today in the program, Gordon Chang is joining us to tell the story of the Chinese railroad workers. His book is Ghosts of Gold Mountain, the epic story of the Chinese who built the Transcontinental Railroad. Gordon Chang is a professor of history at Stanford University. He's coming to Utah this week. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. He joined us from the studios at Stanford. And Chang says he's been interested in this story since he was young, and for obvious reasons.
Well, I'm a fourth-generation Californian, and growing up in the Oakland East Bay area, I had long heard about Chinese railroad workers as part of my ancestry. I found little about them, however, and it has not been until late in my career that I've had time to really explore the topic at some length and found that the history about Chinese railroad workers was woefully inadequate. But Chinese railroad workers was an interest to me and to other Chinese Americans because it was an epic story of effort and sacrifice and seemed to confirm to us our place in American history.
Mm. One of the things that's interesting is you mentioned that in many ways these Chinese workers were presented as kind of mute figures in this story. We didn't see many names. We didn't see many stories necessarily. Why not? Why was there such a lack of documentation? How much of that was prejudice? How much of that was circumstance, as far as you can tell?
One of the problems of recovering the history of Chinese railroad workers is there's a dearth of primary material. After decades of effort by other historians and years of work by myself and other colleagues, we still have not located a single document generated by a Chinese railroad worker, not a memoir, not a diary, not an oral history, not a letter sent back home, nothing at all. So it's very large intellectual challenge to try to write a history when you have nothing from the subjects themselves. So why is that the case?
Yeah.
We know that many of them were literate. We know that because journalists at the time noted that. And we also know that they sent many letters back home across the Pacific. We have manifests of the correspondence trade, the letters sent back and forth. And so we know that material was generated, but what happened to it? We asked our colleagues in China to locate material. They couldn't find material. They believe that much of it was probably destroyed over the years because of revolution and wars and civil strife. In the United States, many Chinese stayed in the United States after the Transcontinental was completed. And they had memorabilia, certainly, and personal effects. But in the 1870s, 1880s, and beyond, there was a virulent anti-Chinese movement, very, very violent. Chinese from scores of communities across the West were driven out and their communities burned down. So we think that lots of stuff was simply destroyed over time, including even in the 1906 earthquake, which burned San Francisco to the ground, including the San Francisco Chinese community. So the material that they generated has been lost to history, although we keep hoping that one day something will turn up.
Yeah. Wasn't easy putting all of this together, of course. You mentioned it meant going through archives and collections, and there was archaeology involved, and it also meant conducting oral histories as well. Talk a little bit about the effort that had to go into trying to create a story like this, recreate this story.
Well, as we try to go out to locate documentary evidence, and as a historian, that's what we do. We try to go find the written document. But I knew that early on we'd have to use other creative methods to recover the story, including re-examining historical photography, doing an extensive search for newspaper accounts. And on that account, I should say something, that because of the digital age in which we live, there's an enormous amount of material now online and available through the Internet that was unavailable to historians before. And we found hundreds of new articles about the Chinese railroad workers that no one had looked at before. And then we worked with archaeologists and learned a lot about archaeology, the effort of these archaeologists to locate material along the railroad lines, particularly in the labor camps. And they found thousands of shards of rice bowls and clothing pieces and cooking utensils and medicine bottles and all sorts of things, gaming pieces. Yeah. And the way they study, they locate this material, map it out, and they can glean something from this material that tells us about how they live their daily lives in these labor camps from and as they moved along the rail line. So there was a lot of different things that we used to now gain some entry into their daily life aside from their own words.
You say in the book, and I'm guessing this is what you're referring to in some ways anyways, that if you pay attention to the physical world of the railroad Chinese, that it helps give us a sense of what life was like for them. Is that what you mean by the physical world?
Well, that's part of it. I would just take one step back and say one thing which I try to do in my work is to position myself and in the position of a Chinese railroad worker, and to use historical empathy to try to recover what they might have experienced. As I look at a photograph, for example, and I see these immense mountains in the snow, and then the photographer has captured workers out there working in the snow, rather than see them as just sort of dark objects placed against the white snow, I try to place myself in their position and to look back at the photographer and to look around this environment there and to gain a sense of what it might have been like. So in the snow, you know, I've gone up to the Sierra Nevada and many other people have, so one can kind of use one's empathy to think of what it might have been like to be a worker to forge this iron road through the Sierra in the dead of winter. So we spent a lot of time to reconstruct the weather patterns and even trying to understand what the weather might have been like on a specific day, what the temperature, what the rainfall, what was the snowfall, what was the sunlight, and so forth. So that makes a difference in trying to think about their lived experience. There are other conditions, just the terrain, certainly, the forests, the mountains, the passes, the wind, natural environment of animal life, of what one might see up in the Sierra, or in the deserts, the vermin, the mosquitoes, mm-hmm. all that, which they certainly encountered as they lived out in these pretty tough conditions.
As you mentioned weather, I'm thinking about, and this is something you write about in the book, I mean, you have on one hand the wind and the intensity of, you know, being in the high Sierras, and then you also have the desert, so you have searing heat. And so they were exposed to all kinds of challenges in that way. And that leads me to something that you say early in the book, where you mention that central to the story is the role of chance in the lives of the railroad Chinese. Explain what
you
mean.
Well, at one point in the early on writing the manuscript, I was playing around with the racist epithet of, someone doesn't have a Chinaman's chance. Mm-hmm. And that came from the 19th century when Chinese were bereft of the protection of the law in many cases. They were victims of all sorts of violent assault and murder. They had difficult lives in marginalized communities in which they were vulnerable to all sorts of danger. And so that's where the term came from, that was used to describe, tough life. So I was thinking about the idea of chance more generally, and thus was able to think about their lives from their home villages in China and coming all the way across the Pacific and then working here. And the risk that was involved in their lives was enormous, and risk means chance.
Yeah.
So what was the chances that they would be able to just get to from their home villages in this somewhat little removed area of China? The Chinese railroad workers all came from a very compact location in China, southern China, near Hong Kong and Macau. Mm-hmm. And they came from rather simple villages. They were farming families. And they had to make their way from there to the ports of Macau or Hong Kong particularly, and then find passage across the ocean. And in that time, trans-Pacific transportation was not regularized. Mm-hmm. So getting across the ocean was dangerous. There was the risk that one could get on the wrong ship and wind up in Peru rather than California. And Peru, where many Chinese went, was a terrible place to be. The Chinese were taken there in semi-slave conditions and forced to work in the guano mines there. And many, many people died horrible deaths in a very bad environment. Sometimes we know from the historical record, including U.S. diplomatic material, State Department material, that Chinese were sometimes tricked or kidnapped to be taken to Peru or to Cuba, where they labored in terrible conditions, or others would go to North America. So there was just chance right there. And then getting along the rail line and encountering all the difficulties we've begun to discuss here, there was this chance of whether one would just even physically survive.
Yeah. We'll come back to the photograph or the photographs that marked the occasion of the coming together of these two railroads. But I did want to ask you about the story that you tell early in the book, about the behind the scenes of that day, of May 10th of 1869. And you tell about how a field construction boss of the Central Pacific Railroad Company, a man by the name of James Strobridge, had gotten some of the dignitaries together after the famous photograph. And he invites three Chinese railroad workers, in fact, a man in particular, Hong Hua, to the occasion.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with that story, because I really like this story a lot. Tell us first who Hong Hua is, please.
The identity of the Chinese railroad workers has been a challenge to know, because we had very few names, only a handful of names. But then as I tried to really dig deeper, I began to locate names, more names on payroll records, and more names on obscure newspapers, and also from other documentary evidence, particularly in the small mining towns in California where Chinese settled beginning in the 1850s. And some of them went into business, which included labor contracting. And one of these early labor contractors was a guy named Hong Hua, who lived in Auburn, north of Sacramento. And Hong Hua was a a very entrepreneurial fellow from what I can tell from the legal records, the business records, and the newspaper accounts.
Yeah.
Auburn was a booming gold mining town, and he went into business providing labor for local white mine owners and others who needed labor. And so he left a paper trail of legal documents, of court cases, of agreements with business partners and some newspaper accounts who talked about him in rather in some detail.
You know what I love about this story, by the way, is just that I think in some ways what we're often left with is just this, you mentioned voiceless, and I think that's exactly right, but just this impression of this monolithic group of people as opposed to individuals. And knowing about Hung Hwa, the fact that he was a little older than some of the Chinese workers on the railroad, in his mid-30s, that he was educated, that he was ambitious, I like that, because I think that that's one of the characteristics of the way the story has been told in the past, is they weren't seen as being individual. They were just sort of all bunched together. And hearing the story of a man named Hung Hwa, and the fact that he was ambitious and the fact that he was involved, I don't know, I really like this telling.
Well, part of history, and the history that I like to do, is to recover real lives.
Yeah.
So that the past is not just faceless or nameless without the vitality of real human beings. And that was the challenge, to try to recover in this project. And I was fortunate enough to stumble across this guy, Hung Hwa, who's never been mentioned before in any other history books. But at the time, in the 1860s, he was quite a prominent fellow in Auburn and in that area.
Yeah.
So we know something about him. And he was perhaps the most prominent Chinese businessman in Auburn, and he knew many of the Chinese laborers. So there is a class differentiation there. But this fellow that you mentioned, James Stobridge, who was the superintendent of construction on the rail line and was tasked early on in 1864 to go out and locate Chinese workers. And he goes to Auburn, and his wife was from Auburn, and presumably he meets Hung Hwa. He talks about meeting a local business guy and begins to hire on Chinese to the rail line. So that's how Chinese began to get on to the Transcontinental Railroad effort.
We should mention that he didn't actually think Chinese workers could do the job at first. He had to be convinced.
Yes, well, the railroad leaders were prejudiced, and also had certain assumptions about the Chinese. They didn't want to hire Chinese. They didn't think they would be physically or temperamentally suitable for tough railroad work. So they were reluctant to hire Chinese, and they wanted to hire explicitly, as they said, just white workers.
Yeah.
But Chinese began to come on the line, and it turns out that they did extraordinarily well, and they hire more, and 50 here, 50 there, and all of a sudden they're up to 3,000 and 5,000 and 10,000, up to 15,000 Chinese workers at the high point of the employment. So Stobridge himself, who was a big burly guy and apparently not averse to using physical violence on the workers against them to work, that he came to have a respect for the Chinese, and at the end invited Chinese after the events at Promontory to honor them. And he talks about his foreman, who was on the line from the very beginning of the effort, and I think that was Hung Hwa.
You mentioned how in that in the personal car of Stobridge, where he's having this gathering, that some of these Chinese men found, this is how you put it in the book, found themselves for the first time in their lives in close proximity to important white men. So how segregated was society, or how segregated was the experience of working on the railroad during that time?
Well, California was a rough and tumble place, a really frontier area, and highly segregated. There was a great deal of violence against Native people. Already there were systematic efforts to exterminate whole communities of Native people.
Yeah.
A very terrible story. The state was populated in the 1850s largely by Southerners. So the California politics was dominated by Southerners, as most people don't know. And the racial prejudice was just commonplace. And Chinese themselves were highly segregated even within the city, certainly within the Chinese quarter, now called Chinatown. And in the mountain areas where they went to work, lived separately from whites and worked separately. And very few whites knew who the Chinese were and what they were like. They couldn't converse with them. Some Chinese learned English and some whites learned Chinese, but they were very, very separate communities. And the Chinese were seen as a community that could be preyed upon by hoodlums and bad people who just wanted to rob them and take their possessions. So the separation between whites and Chinese was really quite large.
It gets us to a kind of a stereotype, and one of the things that you debunk in the book, and it's this kind of this presentation that comes to us that the Chinese were this quiet, meek, submissive types. But you talk about how that's just silly, how they could be garrulous and argumentative, like anyone else, of course. And that they were very – talk a little bit about that, because I think that stereotypical impression that we have of these sort of meek, quiet types is something you really, really go after in the book.
So much of what was thought to be known about Chinese was generated by people who would observe them, a journalist, and certainly – there was a lot of ignorance in those observations. They just didn't know the cultural background. They couldn't converse with them. They didn't understand the interior life of the communities. And over time, this sense of the meek or submissive or servile Chinese became implanted in the minds of many people. And it also was deliberately perpetuated by those who were very hostile to the Chinese. And what I mean by that is that Sinophobes, particularly after the construction of the railroad, feared that Chinese were such efficient workers and good workers that they would take jobs away from European immigrant workers and whites. And a very hostile movement arose and accused the Chinese in part of being susceptible to extra exploitation because they were servile, that they were slave-like, and the term slave is used repeatedly in a lot of the early anti-Chinese diatribes. So the sense that a wage worker could not compete against a slave, could not compete against a servile population, was commonplace. That was part of the old backdrop of the Civil War. And Chinese were tagged with that epithet. And that persisted, although that was so wrong because we know that, as you said, they were quite a risk-taking. I mean, can you try to imagine if you're a servile, why would you leave your village and come way over here and to do all the tough work and to endure everything like this? They were not indentured. They were not kept by force. They made choices. They had chance, and they took risk. And we also know that from their communities, other observers would talk about how loud and garrulous they were. And the Chinese in that part of China are known to be very community-minded, and they love their social life and gatherings. But on the rail line itself, we also know about the famous strike of 1867.
Right.
When in June 1867, at the height of the construction season, 3,000 Chinese workers, railroad workers, up in the High Sierra, simultaneously stopped work.
Yeah.
And they just did not go to their work sites. They just stayed in their labor camps, all on the same day, the same time. And it was an extraordinarily well-coordinated, disciplined action. And it was the largest worker action to date in the United States. Mm-hmm. It's really quite a story.
Yeah.
Although, if you look at the history books, you'll find little if or nothing about the strike, not even a mention of them. So incidents like this, which by any account or any measure are really very, very important and fascinating, are just not even there. So people through the decades didn't know anything about the Chinese and what they did and took sometimes the most stereotypic view of them as being unimportant.
Gordon Chang. His new book is called Ghosts of Gold Mountain, the epic story of the Chinese who built the Transcontinental Railroad. Tomorrow night at 7, he's going to be giving a free lecture at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts. This is part of their celebration. They also have a photography exhibit called The Race to Promontory. He's also going to be giving a reading at the King's English Bookshop on Thursday night. You can get details about both of those events on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about that group of workers who were almost completely left out of that famous photograph of the meeting of the Transcontinental Railroad. We have with us the historian Gordon Chang, who has a book that tells the story of the experience of these Chinese workers, nearly 20,000 of them, who laid nearly 700 miles of track. His book is called Ghosts of Gold Mountain. One of the things that's really important, I think, about the story you tell is you take us back to where these workers came from, to the rural villages located in the Pearl River Delta in South China, to the sea counties of that region, a place which is really interesting you describe as rather small, just about 75 square miles as a kind of the sort of the epicenter of all of this. And you mentioned how there isn't really a full description of village life of the time, but we do have a bit of a sense of it from there was one man, Hui Qin. Mm-hmm. He has a remarkable memoir that does give us a sense of what village life was like for the origins of that place. Say a little bit about that part, if you would.
The area from which they came was called Siyi. Today it's called Siyi, four counties. Mm-hmm. And these four counties are tucked away in an area sort of southeast of Hong Kong, along the southern coast. It's a beautiful area, farming area, separated from the main part of China by mountain ranges on the east and then the oceans on the west. So it's sort of self-contained, and it's rice-growing and fruit-growing region. And 80-90% of the Chinese who came to the United States in the 19th century came from this compact region. It's about the size of a metropolitan area in the United States today. So they didn't come from all over China. They came from a specific region. Yeah. They were all region mates, if you will. Many of them came from the same villages. So they had very strong, tight identity among themselves. And I've visited the area, and it's fascinating to feel the semi-tropical climate there, the bright sun, the verdant greenery, the farmland, the pace of life, and then to think about these fellows 150 years ago leaving that area and making the travel across the Pacific on this great ocean, and then arriving in San Francisco, being taken up into the Sierra Nevada, and then encountering the mountain range there. I can't imagine how they must have thought about now going through the snowstorms of the Sierra and then later on through the blistering desert of Utah and Nevada. But we do have a few accounts of people who made the trek, who were not railroad workers but came from the same region. So this fellow, Hui Qin, who came from one of these villages, and some of these villages today are still known as railroad villages because so many people went out from them to go around to the United States and around the world to build railroads, and they sent money back to sustain their families. But Hui Qin made his way to the United States as a teenager and wound up as a houseboy in Oakland and in other occupations, and then he found Christianity. He converted and eventually became an early Chinese minister and settled in New York. And toward the end of his life in the early 20th century, he wrote a fascinating memoir of his life, including his voyage from his home village coming to America.
You mentioned how life there was structured around, as you put it, the rhythms of farming and the milestones of, you know, life and birth and marriage and death and mourning. But you also say this, you say life did not allow for slackers, which I think is interesting. It's just sort of the, you know, must have been a, I guess life anywhere in a rural village was challenging, and it certainly was for them.
The thought I had about this, and I put that in deliberately because the work ethic of the Chinese from that region was really quite remarkable. I mean, in a sense, they had to have a work ethic. They were poor. Yeah. Farming was tough. There's no mechanization, nothing close to electricity. And so they had to work long hours, a tough existence. But over time, they developed, the population did, this very strong work ethic. And that was noted by those in California of the Chinese who came over here. They really worked hard. And this is one of the reasons why they did so well for the railroad company. Mm. But that has a certain, if you will, not implausible connection to today when people talk about the economic boom in China. Yeah. And the work ethic of a lot of the Chinese workers there. There's a certain sense of being disciplined and to see work as really a fundamental part of life, and they just go to it. And so there's an interesting connection that can be made with the Chinese then and even today.
Yeah. Why did they leave? This is the astonishing thing. You mentioned about how almost one quarter of the population, about 200,000 people or something, left their homes there in the 19th century.
Well, 200,000 left to North America, and then many others left for other parts of the world over the decades and into the early 20th century, especially down into Southeast Asia. So many of the large Chinese communities that one can find in the Philippines or Indonesia or Malaysia and Thailand and so forth all come from the southern Chinese region. Mm-hmm. Very, very interesting. And so this Chinese diaspora today numbers maybe 6-7 million in ancestry from the people who left during those years. But they came to the United States often through chain migration. They would hear about the work that was available. There was not a real cash economy in their villages. And then to hear stories that you come to the North America in the early year, the 1850s, and find gold, which was really attractive to them. Mm-hmm. And then later on, you have to get paid for one's work.
Yeah.
And that was rare in southern China at that time.
So let's talk about the railroad work itself and the significance of the coming together of these two railroads. Now, we should make it clear that the Chinese railroad workers who helped build the rail line, they were part of the CPRR labor force, not the Union mm-hmm. Pacific one. And in mm-hmm. fact, they made up 90% of that labor force. Mm-hmm. Now, they did a little bit less in terms of the actual miles of track, but you mentioned that it was much more challenging work, the western part of that line.
Yes. The completion of the Transcontinental Railroad, as we call it today, was a federally funded and supported effort to expand the rail line roughly from Omaha, Nebraska, out to California.
Right.
And so the federal government selected those two companies, the Union Pacific from Omaha, Nebraska, going westward, and the Central Pacific Railroad coming from Sacramento to build east. Mm-hmm. And the story, which is not inaccurate, is that the two companies set up to do this work, and they were in competition with each other. Why were they in competition? They were in competition because the company that laid the most track would have a greater subsidy from the federal government, but also be able to control the completed length of railroad line. And so the two railroad companies go head-to-head to it, and by going westward from Omaha is not the same as going eastward from Sacramento, where one has to get through the Sierra foothills and then through the immense mountain range which separates California from the rest of the country. And the Sierra Nevada is the most forbidding or mountain range there is in the continental United States. It's made out of solid granite. It has a short work season. They have very fierce winter storms. Even today, with global warming, snow stays on the ground well into the summer. One can ski up into July, and that's exactly the area where the rail line went, right past Lake Tahoe mm-hmm. and Donner Summit, which is also infamous because of the tragic experience of the Donner Party that was trying to make its way into California in the late 1840s. That's the area where the rail line had to go through, and the Chinese had to construct the line. So the two companies, the Union Pacific, laid more track than the Central Pacific, but the Central Pacific had to get through the Sierra Nevada. And without the Chinese, it has to be said, they probably never would have gotten out of California.
Yeah.
Before they started hiring Chinese, the white workers, they made a dozen miles of track in a year and a half. But the idea of getting through the Sierra required thousands of workers, and they just were not to be had.
Yeah.
So Leland Stanford, who headed the Central Pacific Railroad, and his colleagues, who were now known as the Big Four, Collis Huntington, Mark Hopkins, and Charles Crocker, along with Stanford as the Big Four, would probably be known as the Little Four. And the Stanford University, and this is sort of the paradox or irony of all this, is that I might not even be here because there might not be a Stanford University. So Stanford became enormously wealthy because of the railroad and that was constructed by the Chinese, and he had the generosity to found Stanford later on in the 19th century. So there's a whole chain of events that were allowed to happen because of the efforts of the Chinese.
You mentioned for that five-year period, some 20,000 Chinese workers helped build that rail line. And the Chinese, you mentioned, were the largest single workforce in American industry to that date. That's amazing.
Yes, well, when things about it, what other industries hired hundreds, let alone thousands of workers? The Industrial Revolution was in some ways really enabled by the railroad system. You had to mine iron ore, you had to mine coal, you'd transport goods back and forth, you open up markets. And that happens through the latter part of the 19th century. But before that time, even during the Civil War, the munitions factories didn't hire more than a few hundred workers. So this is a large enterprise, the railroad enterprise. And the Chinese were a single ethnic labor force. The Union Pacific hired workers who had come from Europe, Irish immigrants, free people after the Civil War, Civil War veterans, a whole variety of different people worked on the Union Pacific, and there were thousands who worked on that line as well. And I should also say that we also don't know very much about the daily lives of the Union Pacific workers, and that's been part of our history, which still is a lot to be done, where we want to know about the lives of everyday people. And it's one thing to learn about Leland Stanford or others who were the railroad barons, because they left voluminous records and personal documentation. But the fellows, the men and women who worked on these lines, have been forgotten, and we don't know what their lives were like.
What did they wear? This was interesting. You described them as dressing like soldiers in an army.
The uniform of the Chinese was similar. When we see photos of the workers, we see them dressed similarly. Mm-hmm. The white workers dressed in more variety, in part because they came from many different backgrounds. Let me just as a sidelight, if one can look at the famous photo of Promontory Summit, the meeting of East and West, the two engines meeting head to head and people celebrating in front, which might be the most well-known photo from the 19th century. But if you take a look at that photo and use a magnifying glass, it's a fascinating study that one can have to look at the faces of these mainly white workers or white observers, and to look at their dress, which I've done. And you can see that they wear hats that look like from Eastern Europe. They wear woolens. They wear boots of various sorts. They're really quite a diverse group. But when we do this, use same type of study of the photographs of the railroad workers, we see them dressed fairly similarly. In the early stages of their employment, they seem to wear the straw hats woven from bamboo or palm that they knew so well from southern China. But later on, their uniform changes. They look like they're wearing denim, they're wearing light cotton, they're wearing cotton hats, and leather boots, and they dress similarly. So that's why I call them an army. And the people at the time called them an army because they worked in such a notable coordination and efficiency that they seemed to be, they laid down track just like an army.
Yeah. Let's talk about that famous photo. What do you make of the fact that there were no Chinese faces? I mean, you mentioned in the book that some see this as a deliberate slight, but you're not sure there's any evidence for that. That a photographer, for example, just told the Chinese people not to be involved. What do you make of that photograph? How do you explain it?
That photograph was taken moments after the formal ceremony, presided over by Leland Stanford. The photographer's name, A.J. Russell, Andrew J. Russell, a very accomplished photographer, who arranged the scene. There were a couple of other photographers on the site as well and took similar photos, but his has come to be the most famous.
Yeah.
But it's all very haphazard, that he just called people together, brought the two engines sort of head-to-head, and then the people just sort of took over and positioned themselves. And there's no indication by any of the journalists, the print journalists at the time, that there was deliberate exclusion of Chinese from the photo. And in fact, some of the officials at times said, let's get the Irish and the Chinese in the photo, you know, the workers, and because they laid literally the last track.
Yeah.
But it didn't happen. But it didn't sound like someone said, no, we don't want them. It was just a bit chaotic at the site and very ad hoc. But we know from photographs that Russell and others took before the iconic photo that we can see the Chinese rail workers literally laying the last rails. And that's the title of one of A.J. Russell's photographs of that occasion. You see the Chinese dressed in these denims and light cotton with cotton hats and laying the last track. And he entitles his photo, Laying the Last Track. But over time, the absence of a Chinese face in that photo has been taken by many Chinese Americans as deliberate erasure, as deliberate exclusion, and linked to the marginalization or the erasure of Chinese American history from American history and Chinese railroad workers from railroad history specifically. And thus, the photo angers many Chinese Americans to this day who say that this is a symbolic of the erasure of Chinese from the national past. But I understand that sentiment, and I think the photo can be taken as symbolic of that marginalization in history. But I took a much closer look at that photo early on in the research project, and in fact, we were up at the Sacramento State Railroad Museum, and my wife took a look at this photo, which was blown up to about half the size of a billboard. And she said, who is this fellow here? And we looked at it and said, my goodness, it looks like one of the fellows who laid the last rail. Although his back is toward the camera, but he has the same type of work clothes. And you can see that they're tattered. He's dressed very differently than the whites in the photo. And he's moving. So he's blurry. And it's easy to miss him. But anybody who could see that photo, you can go online and find the photo. He's smack dab in the middle of the photo with his back to the camera. The others are facing the camera, and maybe they were more familiar with the photography at the time, and they were more important to try to get their face in the picture, which they did. And he didn't really care. So he's actually kind of walking around, and that's why he's blurry. So he is in the frame. So in a sense, we've recovered at least a portion of the Chinese story even in the photo itself.
Yeah.
There may be other Chinese mixed into the crowd because there are people who are obscure. They have a hat. There's one fellow who's got a hat raised up, covering, looks like covering someone's face. And so they're around in that area. I should also point out that there's really no photo of Leland Stanford tapping in the golden spike,
right,
which was the high point of the event. And it said that in some accounts that as he was doing so, there was a photograph taken at the time, but the photographer dropped the glass plate and it broke.
Right.
So the moment is lost. So there are all sorts of reasons why historical moments are not recorded.
Yeah. You do mention, though, that the Chinese efforts have not been mentioned over time, historically, of course. And this was particularly clear in the 1969 centennial celebration. The Chinese mention of them was left out of that celebration. Would you? Talk a little bit about that, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, historical commemoration is an interesting topic itself. How and why do we commemorate certain things, and how we commemorate them at certain times changes over time. So at the 50th anniversary of the completion of the line, Chinese were honored. They were in the parade. Newspaper accounts talk about how the Chinese crew that laid the last track were brought out of retirement. These fellows were now in their 80s or something like this, and they're all wizened, and they look like they really didn't care to be bothered. But anyway, there, so they were in the photographs of the 50th anniversary. And they dressed up in work clothes and work implements, and they're mentioned in the newspapers, and even their names are given. Mm-hmm. But at the 100th anniversary, they're absent. Nothing is included about the Chinese. They literally are written out of the celebration, and it sort of reflects the history that was written on the previous 50 years, that the Chinese, instead of becoming more and more included in the story, mm-hmm, are more and more excluded from the story. And at the event in 1969, the Secretary of Transportation, John Volpe, it's a great nationalist boast about only the vigor of Americans could build such a project. Only Americans could build a track through Sierra Winters. Only Americans could build 10 miles of track in one day, which is what the Chinese did, mm-hmm, with this extraordinary record they made just before Promontory. And then Volpe mentions other European ethnicities as contributing to the effort, but not one mention of the Chinese. And in addition, the Chinese could not become citizens of the United States, could not become Americans at the time because of federal law. Chinese were prohibited from becoming naturalized citizens until 1943.
Mm. I want to have you tell one final story, which was my favorite, I think, from the book, and that is you mentioned that really astonishing record of laying 10 miles of track in one day. You talk about how a group of Chinese workers went up to a higher vantage point to look down at the work that they had done, and they took with them a jug, and just how proud they were of that work they had done. And it gave such, again, another really nice story of individuals, not just this mass, but this group of people who were proud of what they had accomplished.
Well, that is a great story, and I like the way you've summarized it. That is an example of the work of archaeologists. They had been looking at the rail line, and they themselves took a break from walking along the rail track and went to this bluff near Promontory Summit. And lo and behold, they found an intact Chinese rice wine jug stuck in the rocks. It had been stuck there for 140 years or something like this sort, they surmise. We don't know how the bottle got there specifically.
Yeah. Yeah.
We don't know who drank from it and if it was one person or a group of guys. But there it was. And thus we can think maybe there was one fellow who got drunk up there. The work was over with and he was thinking about going home or thinking about going to New York. Now the rail line is done. It could have been a group of fellows up there who were, you know, relaxing, maybe under the stars. Beautiful scenery to overlook. You could see the distant Great Salt Lake. And wondered about their lives. They were all young men in their teens and in their 20s, and they had their life ahead of them. They survived. They survived the chance. They fought, survived the risk of the railroad. And so they may have been wondering about what to do with the rest of their life. But that object, if we just think about it as a simple bit of what's called material culture, remain, and it prompts us to use our own human thought to think about people far removed from us in a distant time, but maybe not so distant that we can't imagine what their existence might have been like.
Gordon Chang. He's an historian at Stanford University. His book is Ghosts of Gold Mountain, the epic story of the Chinese who built the Transcontinental Railroad. Tomorrow night, Professor Chang is going to be giving a lecture at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts on the campus of the University of Utah. Thursday, he's giving a reading at the King's English in Salt Lake City. You can get information on all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. The show is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.